Good morning. Welcome. I'm Rick Barton, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS, and on behalf of John Hamry, and who's the president of CSIS, Kurt Campbell, who is the head of the International Security Program, my colleagues in the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, in particular Karen von Hippel, I'd like to welcome you. It's great to have you here. I think we've got a wonderful program this morning. Really a provocative issue that is going to be well discussed in the next couple hours, so we're pleased to have you here. It's obviously one of the real pleasures of being in Washington is that we get a chance to have guests such as these speakers today and to have a lot of people who are working on these issues come together in an open and informal format. So we're hoping to leave lots of time for conversation. One of the other great pleasures of being here in Washington is the colleagues that we have to work with. And so I'd like to thank the other projects here and programs here at CSIS that have helped to sponsor this. I see Sarah Mendelson, who from the Russia and Eurasia program, who has helped us with this and has been doing some parallel work as well. Clearly, John Alderman's Middle East program. I see some people from his project here. Steve Morrison and Jennifer Cook's Africa program have also helped. There's a terrorism project that is being worked on right now by Julie Smith and Dan Benjamin that some of you are probably working with, and then Tezi Schaefer's South Asia program. So this particular issue really cuts across a lot of very various pieces of CSIS, and you are seeing work, some of their work that's related to the subject showing up every day. There are probably some other colleagues here that are doing also other work. I'm sorry if I didn't credit you directly, but anyway, there's a lot going on. If you visit our website, you'll see that CSIS is really taking a lead role in the subject and trying to be, as usual, come up with responsible solutions. Leora Danan from our project is going to do the introductions today, and I think probably another great pleasure of being in Washington is that we all have the chance to work with lots of bright young colleagues who are probably the future leaders of our policymaking world, and they come here with great commitment and a lot of talent, and hopefully that all grows in places like CSIS. So I've seen that with Leora. It's a great pleasure to have her on our team, and I know you'll look forward to hearing her introduction of our speakers today.
Thank you, Rick. We're so glad to have David Cook and Olivia Allison join us today because their important work narrows in on the issue of the role of religion in conflict-prone settings, an area of analysis that CSIS's Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project has found critical in the places that we've worked and that we've identified as an issue area which requires more attention by policymakers. Recent changes suggest that many U.S. government officials have begun to acknowledge the importance of religion in the formulation and implementation of U.S. policy in conflict-prone states. Perhaps reflecting this trend, a quick analysis shows that President Bush's first 2002 national security strategy referred to religion only four times, but that by 2006, the national security strategy includes seven references to religious freedom, nine mentions of Islam, always in the context of the war on terror or of terrorism, and three general references to the issue of religion and conflict. Despite this new level of recognition, and while some accompanying policies and initiatives have been significant, the U.S. government has a long way to go in developing full analyses and coherent strategies. Many policymakers remain reluctant to deal with the issue of religion, whether because they believe religion is an issue irrelevant to foreign policy or too sensitive an issue to deal with explicitly. Reactionary new policies are uninformed by a breadth of religious expertise, and many obstacles still prohibit effective government partnerships with religious groups. The PCR Project's research on this issue, with the support of the Henry Luce Foundation, aims to help government devote its resources and energy to addressing religion in a more strategic manner. Though there are no simple solutions, certain approaches to understanding religion in theory and in practice can improve the work of policymakers and practitioners. Foremost is the importance of taking religion seriously as a hard security issue and a powerful dynamic in local, regional, and global politics. Policymakers should not discount, of course, the role of national identity, political power or economic factors in so-called religious conflicts, in many so-called religious conflicts, but they must also not underestimate the role of religion in both conflict and peacemaking. Our speakers today, David Cook and Olivia Allison, have contributed to this critical area of analysis in their new work, Martyrdom Operations: Policy Responses to Suicide Bombings. David and Olivia have just completed a book project funded by the Smith Richardson Foundation and the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy, which will be published by Prager in 2007. They received a grant to study the spread of support for suicide bombings, focusing on the religious aspects of the problem of suicide attacks and understanding religion as a key determining factor in the creation of suicide bombers. For their research, these authors conducted fieldwork in 15 African countries, the Middle East, Eurasia, and South and Southeast Asia. In each of these countries, they interviewed religious leaders and journalists, local officials, and laypeople to study radical Islam and the range of support for martyrdom operations in the Muslim world. Through these interviews, they examined the historical and religious roots of suicide attacks among radicalized Muslims, exploring ways to combat the cultural and ideological basis for suicide attacks. David is focused on the history and technical aspects of martyrdom and militant groups, while Olivia focused on the role of media and policymakers. Based on these two areas of research, they've compiled a number of specific policy recommendations for how to confront support for suicide bombing operations, especially focusing on religious aspects for this support. David and Olivia were well placed to conduct this research. David is a professor of Islamic studies in the Religious Studies Department at Rice University. He received his PhD and MA from the University of Chicago and MA and BA from Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He's authored five books, including Understanding Jihad, Studies in Muslim Apocalyptic, and Contemporary Muslim Apocalyptic Literature. David has given hundreds of interviews and lectures on historical and contemporary Islamic issues. Olivia is a graduate researcher with King's College London's International Peace and Security Program. She studied media extensively in the former Soviet Union, Africa, and parts of the Middle East. After completing her BA in Slavic Studies, focusing on Russian from Rice University, she received a fellowship to study Central Asian media for over a year in the region. Her publications include work on martyrdom, operations in Muslim media, Central Asian media law, and media in Yemen and Nigeria. David and Olivia, we look forward to hearing the results of your work, and thank you again for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Leora. We'd also like to thank CSIS for supporting us and hosting our presentation here this morning. And thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to a very fruitful discussion on this important topic. We'll start off by talking a little bit about the historical and tactical aspects of martyrdom operations. Just for clarification, we tend to use the term suicide attacks, martyrdom operations interchangeably, so don't be confused if we happen to do that. Martyrdom operations is the term that's most commonly used in the Arab and Muslim world, obviously having a more laudatory aspect. Suicide attacks obviously are the more common term within the Western media. From a tactical and historical point of view, we're going to be focusing mostly upon those aspects that appear within the Muslim world. And the reasons for that are fairly manifold. Although there's been a number of works on suicide attacks in general that have appeared within the last 10 years, and most of those have dealt with suicide attacks overall and focused somewhat on historical aspects or those that are connected with the Sri Lankan LTTE that is also extremely prominent in the use of suicide attacks. However, the fact is for the United States point of view, from a policymaker's point of view, basically suicide attacks today means suicide attacks by radical Muslims. And therefore, our work focuses almost exclusively upon that aspect of things. Now, from a tactical point of view, historical tactical point of view, the first time that the United States came across suicide attacks from radical Muslims was in Lebanon. During the 1983-84 interlude in which the United States stationed forces in Beirut, it was attacked in a number of different cases by Shiite suicide attackers, most commonly associated with Hezbollah. However, this particular interlude was fairly periodic. It did not leave much of an effect upon United States policy. And it was really not until the September 11th suicide attacks that we begin to find actual United States noticing suicide attacks as a specific phenomenon. However, the period between 1983 and 2001 was characterized by a great deal of development in suicide attacks in the Muslim world. And the major leap that happened right there was, first of all, the use, successful use to some extent, of suicide attacks by Hezbollah, first of all against Israel in South Lebanon, and then eventually their abandonment of this particular tactic, which happened in the late 1980s, as gradually Hezbollah began to apparently realize that suicide attacks against military targets were actually ineffectual. This is a point that we'll come back to. But gradually, people began to focus more upon the use of suicide attacks as a political weapon against civilians. Now, this is not the initial use, as I say, by Shiites, but it gradually developed in this manner. So by the end of the 1980s, pretty much within the Muslim world, suicide attacks are localized within a few fringe groups, gradually begin to being used by the radical Kurds against the Turkish government and so forth by the early 1990s. But it's really not until the middle 1990s that we begin to find radical Sunni groups beginning to pick up martyrdom operations and beginning to justify them. Now, the interesting thing that we've discovered in our research is that there's no justification given by Shiites to the use of martyrdom operations. Okay, and they did not actually call them martyrdom operations until later on. They called them simply suicide attacks. So there was no attempt on the earlier Shiite manifestation of this phenomenon to actually prettify the term at all. It was only when this tactic made the leap into Sunnism that we begin to find this term martyrdom operations, which very closely connects the suicide attack, the suicide, with the idea of being a martyr, and glorifies it very strongly. And so then it's only from the middle 1990s that we begin to find large-scale justifications of suicide attacks or martyrdom operations within the Sunni context. This highlights what we consider to be an extremely important point, that there is some amount of difficulty in justifying these tactics to the Sunni world. This is not an easy sell, necessarily. Now, as we look at it today, where there's widespread support for suicide attacks against certain targets and so forth, this might not be necessarily so evident, and we can discuss it. But I believe that there is some amount of sensitivity that is actually being revealed by the prevalence of justifications for suicide attacks, which are extremely widespread throughout the Sunni world. So by the middle 1990s, first of all, we find that suicide attacks begin to pass to the Palestinians, gradually at first, but then taking up speed after the outbreak of the Al-Aqsa Intifada in the fall of 2000, and then gradually making a leap over into the Chechens. The Chechens fighting a battle against a battle for independence against the Russian authorities starting in the middle 1990s, but not using suicide attacks. Gradually, suicide attacks start to appear also there by the summer of 2000. And from there, then we begin to find they're extremely widespread into radical Islam as a whole. Okay, radical Islam, by that I mean Al-Qaeda in this particular case. Now, there are a number of different other manifestations of suicide attacks that are also on the side, and we want to highlight them because they're important to take into consideration when we consider confronting the religious aspects of suicide attacks. These appear in countries where there's no obvious Western interests involved in the suicide attacks that are going on. Several examples of those include the sectarian warfare that goes on in Pakistan, where there are regular suicide attacks being used between the dominant Sunni majority and the Shiite minority. Frequent use of suicide attacks, especially those to desecrate important religious sites and to kill prominent religious personalities, extremely important. Then appearance of suicide attacks in places such as Bangladesh and even Uzbekistan. These are, again, not focused apparently upon obvious Western targets, but appear as part of an internal social strife that is so common inside these countries. Now, and then also then there's appearance of suicide attacks in places randomly, such as Algeria, during the first phase of the Algerian Civil War. Okay, so how are we to take all of this together? Let's go back to the religious justification for the suicide attacks. Starting in 1995, the Egyptian Jamaat al-Islamiyya, led at that particular time by Ayman al-Zawahiri, today Osama bin Laden's second in command, carried out a suicide attack in the Egyptian embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. And this was met with some amount of disagreement within the radical Islamic community. So Zawahiri published, actually, the first Sunni justification of the of suicide attacks. Okay, it's from this, from the ideas that he published, actually, that we begin to find his widespread idea that this is a form of martyrdom, and then finally exalted into the highest form of martyrdom by the time that the Al-Aqsa Intifada breaks out. There, again, when the Chechens start to use suicide attacks in the early 2000s, then there appear a number of different Saudi Arabian penned justifications of suicide attacks. All of these focus upon the question of whether suicide attacks are actually suicide or not. Okay? This is an important point. Suicide is very harshly punished inside Islamic religious doctrine. The suicide is usually deemed to be in hell, eternally suffering, in the same way as he committed suicide. For example, if he stabbed himself with a knife, then he's said usually to spend eternity stabbing himself, goring himself with a knife, and so forth. And so it was important for these justifications actually to make a differentiation between suicide and suicide attacks. Okay, now this might seem somewhat of a stretch from our point of view, but this is precisely the point at which those religious opponents of suicide attacks most strongly opposed the tactic. Okay, that it was likely to be actually confused with suicide. Now, there's another aspect of suicide attacks that gradually came under note, and that's the indiscriminate killing that happens. Now, when the Shiites first began to use this tactic, of course, that was one of the selling points. But as it made the leap into being a tactic that was purely used against civilians, it began to be questionable about whether this could be considered to be jihad. Jihad has a very high standpoint within religious Muslim tradition, and but there's very strict guidelines that are attached to jihad. Among those are making sure that women and children, elderly, and others that are deemed to be non-combatants are not killed. So when one is using martyrdom operations, obviously that element of discrimination between combatants and non-combatants, even in the broadest sense, assuming that all males of a given society are in some way or another combatants, was completely lost. And so a number of opponents of the use of martyrdom operations attacked martyrdom operations exactly on that particular point. And that it continues to be a weakness that we see even today. An even more difficult rationalization had to happen when gradually, as Ayman al-Zawahiri faced in 1995, radical Muslims had to face the question about on what basis do they kill indiscriminately other Muslims. This also continues to be a very strong point against the use of martyrdom operations on a regular basis. Opponents of martyrdom operations attack them. Major operations such as the London bombings, the Bali bombings, the bombings in Riyadh in 2003 are usually dealt with. There's usually some sort of an attack by senior religious scholars precisely on that particular point. And so I think it's a very sensitive one, actually, for radical Muslims. And they usually publish some sort of a defense against that idea as well. Now, since 2003, the primary focus of martyrdom operations has obviously been Iraq. And here, beyond the hundreds of operations that we can find in, among Palestinians and so forth, and the few dozen that have been carried out by the Chechens, in Iraq we find this huge pattern of martyrdom operations or suicide attacks that has really become, during the last 3 years, really the strategy of the Iraqi Sunni radical Muslims. And this is something that has, in addition, come under a great deal of attack, by, especially in recent past, by certain radical Muslim leaders who feel that this indiscriminate bloodshed, especially of Shiites, has become way too excessive. So we'll discuss this particular aspect of things. It's obvious that Iraq is a major factor in contemporary policy. But it's important to see how Iraqi tactics are gradually now being spread throughout the globe. Various different graduates of Iraq are now making their way to other different places, most especially to Afghanistan, where tactics that are associated with Iraq, mass suicide attacks and so forth, are becoming more and more prevalent during this last year, and much more lethal than they had been prior to that time. So with that, I'd like to make the transition into the presentation of my colleague, Olivia, who's going to be discussing the media presentation of these particular attacks.
Okay. I'm going to be looking at the media from two different aspects. First of all, it'll be Arabic language media and especially media releases from militant organizations, and then the way that Western media have covered these attacks. So, first of all, most of these militant organizations have websites or they have messages that they send out, a lot of releases. A lot of the, you know, high-ranking al-Qaeda leaders, you've probably seen their videos or parts of their videos on CNN or, you know, just if not, most of the time CNN isn't actually showing, you know, the whole video, but just a short clip of it, the main message or something like that. But on the internet, there's a lot of these materials, and a lot of that is getting kind of recycled on a lot of different Arabic language media. A lot of it is being put in newspapers and messages like that. But despite, you know, this administration and this Congress's, a lot of their statements against Arab media, especially Al Jazeera and not as much Arabia because of its affiliation with Saudi government. But there's been a lot of criticism of the Arabic language media just saying that, you know, they're letting all of this information come out and all the propaganda come out. But actually, when you look at Al Jazeera, there's definitely, and all the Arab media, there's definitely a shift away from calling these things uniformly martyrdom attacks. Al Jazeera has said that they're not going to call them martyrs, that the suicide bombers, they're not calling them martyrs unless it's in a quote, and then they'll use the quote, but they're not, their newscasters aren't supposed to say, you know, martyr anymore. And Arabia has, Al Arabiya has said that they're not going to give any, you know, direct releases from the militant organizations, and they're not going to show any of these tapes that they get. So there's definitely a shift away from using this material in a way that is really angering a lot of militant groups who view the Arab media as their only outlet, basically, because they're not necessarily going to get their materials on CNN or on BBC or Western media. So this has really angered a lot of the militant organizations, and some people have actually called them, you know, called their media relations a total failure, and that they're not getting their message out at all. So they definitely turned to informal media, a lot of websites, and a lot of material has been written about this, but basically there's definitely a few. There's almost every militant organization has some website, but they're hard to chase around. First of all, they're in Arabic, so they appeal to only populations that speak or read Arabic. And then second, they move a lot. They get shut down, their servers get shut down, and things like that. So they are constantly being shut down. But there's also websites that appeal to, they're in English, like this one website, Clearinghouse, Infoblad.net, and other chat boards that just show the videos. And now lately with YouTube and video trading websites like that, Google Video, there's a lot of suicide bombing videos and martyrdom videos that you can just easily look for and view. If you look for, I'll show you. A search on YouTube just the other day. Yeah, hold on. Okay. This is a search from YouTube that I did just the other day. I don't know if you can see it, but if you just type in suicide bombing or something like that, you get 160 videos. So not all of those are, you know, direct videos from militant organizations, but a lot of them are. A lot of them are news clips and stuff like that, so you're getting a lot of different types of media, but you also get just, there's a couple of videos right now. I mean, like, on a daily basis, there's a new video about suicide bombing. A lot of it's directly coming from websites that collect just militant videos, like ogrish.com and stuff like that, but a lot of it is just, you know, you can still hear the sound and you can still hear what people are saying, and there's a lot of propaganda. People will say, like, you know, like, praise to God that this happened. And I'll show you a message board. These are comments from the video, and you can see that one of the people says murder, you know, these people give your religion a bad name. But other people are saying Allah Akbar, that's what you Americans get when you attack another country. And so there's a lot of this kind of dialogue. And from personal research, I know that if people make a pro-martyrdom comment, they'll get emails from other people, you know, saying, well, check out this website or post this video right now so that we can, like, distribute this message much faster. And right now on YouTube, this is one of the most popular suicide bombing videos. There's probably about 10 copies of it. Just
تهون الحياة وكل يهون وكل يهون
ولا أهل المارقون
تهون
هذه الأنفس
سهلة. This guy talks for a minute. You can hear everything that he says.
تهون حياتنا وأولادنا وأموالنا ويهون كل شيء ولكن إسلامنا لا يهون. يا أخوة عليكم بهذا الطريق الله يجمعنا وإياكم في جنات النعيم. أخوكم أبو عمر الأزدي.
تداهين لا أيها المارقون أيها المارقون تهون الحياة تهون الحياة وكل يهون تهون الحياة
الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
الله أكبر
So that's one of the videos. There's probably at least 10 or 15 copies of that on YouTube, and there's a lot of, you know, messaging about it and discussions of it. And that's something, before, you know, if you had to chase down these videos from a radical site or something, they're difficult to find. You'd have to really kind of be following them, because a lot of times they change on a daily or weekly or monthly basis, so you really need to be in it. But now you can just, anybody can search for that, or it could come up if you just search for insurgent in Iraq and stuff like that. So it's easier to get this kind of message out. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily getting out to everyone. You'd have to some degree, look for it, but it's still really widespread. And there's a lot of videos, just operational videos. I'll just show another short clip from old conflicts, too. This is from
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
It just goes on like that. But you don't get the benefit of the you know, speaking in this one, but you can get a lot of these videos just very easily, and especially if you just go to the website. I mean, you know, links to those things are posted all over, and it also on YouTube, you can click to other websites that have linked to those videos. So you could potentially have a radical site had linked to that, then you could go to the Radical site and read more or something like that. So there's a lot of this trading that's going on, and the videos are really widespread, and it's been definitely a good for media relations for and definitely getting out to, you know, European and American converts potentially, or other groups of people, you know, that may not be able to read Arabic but might be interested in, you know, participating and might be more of a threat to Western societies because they can travel much more freely. So it's just an interesting, definitely the amount of discussion that goes on. If somebody posts a video, they'll get, you know, a lot of messages from a lot of other people. So there's a community growing up in a lot of these sites. And it's also a really good way to keep the people who posted their anonymity is much more secure. If you pass out pamphlets or something, you can easily get arrested in a lot of Muslim countries. But if you, you know, just post something on the internet, it's much harder to trace. So, anyway, but basically, people, the radical groups are not happy with the way they're being covered in mainstream media. And so, and definitely with CNN or something, despite the fact that a lot of people in the U.S. are criticizing the media for letting all this terrorist ideology get out or promoting terrorism and a lot of criticisms that you get like that, that's not the way that people are viewing it. And in my research, I did some quantitative research on CNN coverage about how much they're actually covering the suicide bombings. And I used Vanderbilt News Archive and compared it with Robert Pape's list of suicide bombings in a certain time period. So in terms of the number of suicide bombings that they're, that CNN and American media are covering, So I found that definitely the whole idea of suicide bombing became a much higher news priority after September 11th. I studied CNN and NBC. So after September 11th, just per se, news value increased for suicide bombing. But I also found that despite popular assumption that basically if you had more casualties, you would get more news coverage, that's actually not what I found at all. Or to some degree it does, but actually what trumps that are policy considerations in terms of U.S. policy interests or perceived policy interests in different parts of the world. So coverage by location, you can see that like Al-Qaeda attacks get by far the most coverage. But Israel and Iraq attacks are roughly the same. And then things that have less perceived news value, like Sri Lanka didn't get covered at all on NBC. The Indian Kashmir thing didn't get covered at all on CNN. So that was interesting. But another thing that was important was that despite the perceived news value of, say, suicide bombings in Pakistan or suicide bombings in Afghanistan, those are covered very little. So there's also, despite the fact that that could actually endanger a lot of troops, especially in Afghanistan, almost all the targets are U.S. troops, they still get covered very little. They get much less coverage than, you know, Israeli or obviously Al-Qaeda attacks. And I found that there was only a weak correlation between the number of people killed and how much time and whether it was covered or not. But in terms of content analysis, the motives are not covered very often. Previous studies in the 1980s found that suicide bombing coverage or the terrorist coverage usually focused on personal motives instead of political motives, so like the person was desperate to carry out some kind of terrorist attack or something like that. But I found the opposite, that if there was ever a motive given, it was given as a political motive, you know, like to stop the elections. It was usually a blanket explanation in Iraq or in Israel also in the peace process and stuff like that. But it was always a political motive, but it was never backed up by a statement by any militant organization. It was just kind of thrown in on the side, like, you know, this suicide attack happened today in an attempt to derail the peace process. But it didn't, you know, you could easily quote from some of these statements saying, you know, the peace process is bad, we want to have, you know, our entire state or whatever, but they don't ever quote from that. They don't back it up with anything. And so not any ideological coverage is getting out of the motives. And there was also an emphasis on female suicide bombers. There's only four times on CNN that they actually showed any clips of the martyrdom videos with the person standing up in front of the flag. You've probably seen them. Out of those four, three of them were females. So there's kind of a desire to, I don't know if it's because of the exotic aspect of female suicide bombers or they would focus on family history with those suicide bombers, but the same holds true a lot of times for male suicide bombers, but that focus was never received on male suicide bombers, just not female suicide bombers. And there was not really very much attempt to explain why a person would carry that out. It would just kind of say, you know, election process or whatever. BBC had the same problem, actually, in studying the way that they covered the suicide attacks all over the world, just different Al-Qaeda and, you know, Israeli attacks. They never gave explanations, and they never relied on any statements. They also have a policy that they don't use the word terrorist or terrorism. But despite the stated policy, there's actually a lot of use of the word terrorism in there, especially after July 7th bombings. And then they needed to justify their policy because they actually came under a lot of attack, especially after the July 7th bombings, that they don't use the word terrorist, but people were saying, well, these are terrorist attacks. And so their chairman definitely went against what he said before and said that the word terrorist wasn't banned and that it was up to individual editors to decide when and where to use it. And that they use the word terror and terrorism and terrorist very, very freely. So it's a really interesting that despite their stated policy, which is that terrorist is actually an obstruction to the dialogue on terrorism, and they don't use that word, that their chairman is like, no, actually, we, you know, use it all the time. But both channels, both CNN and NBC and BBC, all used a lot of dialogue about how there's nothing you can do as a democratic government to stop suicide bombing, and that if you have fanatical young men who want to kill themselves, there's nothing you can do. And so this kind of hopelessness is not useful for this debate about, you know, what policies. If you just are automatically coming at it from an assumption that there's absolutely nothing that you can do, then, you know, it's not very useful for coming up with any kind of response or anything like that. So, and you would think BBC was a little bit better about, you know, their policymakers would say something like, there are actually things that we can do and we're trying to do them or something. But American politicians were just not interested in engaging that criticism at all. They just would kind of agree, yeah, there's nothing you can do. So overall, in terms of global media, they have upheld rather than undermined official versions of these conflicts, BBC and CNN and NBC. But at the same time, the Arab media is not working as hard as our government would say that it is to undermine our official version. They're not using the word martyr as much, maybe in quotes, but not by their newscasters. And they're not giving, you know, total visibility to all those statements that are coming out and stuff like that. So that's basically what I found in terms of media. And then, do you want to talk about policy? Yeah.
Okay. Basically, the goal of suicide attacks is to engender terror inside a population. Now, when we look at suicide attacks, probably most of us think of what we, in rather undiplomatic terms, call spectacular attacks. Those attacks that kill large numbers of people, such as September 11th or other different prominent attacks like the London attacks. However, when radical groups analyze their record, they look at the entire range of suicide attacks. Now, these include a great many attacks that we would consider to be failed, that they killed virtually nobody or just wounded people, or sometimes the bomber exploded himself prematurely and so forth. Okay, this is, however, part of a range of terror. And it's important for us to consider the phenomenon as a whole, because basically the goal is not just merely to kill people, but to engender a state of terror and hopelessness like that quote exemplified. It's to give a society a sense that there is nothing that they can do and that they must somehow or another either compromise or accede to the demands of the attackers. Okay, now this is something that the military analysis have talked about as a form of asymmetrical warfare. It's an attempt to, let's say, even a balance between two different sides that possess dramatically different abilities. Let's say Israel versus the Palestinians. Let's say the United States versus Al-Qaeda. Let's say Russia versus the Chechens and so forth. Now, the question is, do these things really accomplish what their planners try and make for them? Okay, Robert Pape, a prominent suicide bombing analyst, most prominent book probably that's been written on the subject, Dying to Win, has argued that basically suicide attacks work because they're successful because they work. Now, we would like to qualify that to some extent, okay? Because many of the points that he brings out are actually fairly older in nature. And as my colleague Olivia has noted here, it's very difficult to know what precisely are the goals of the people that we're talking about. Are they really blowing themselves up to stop the elections or to derail the peace process in the way that analysts would say? And so when we're trying to devise a method to deal with suicide attacks, we have to confront that problem of our inability to comprehend. Okay, suicide attacks offend us in a lot of different ways. They basically are a problem for our psyche, I suppose you might say. They offend us because the person is so contemptuous of us that he won't even stand for justice. There's no way that we can get him. The best that we can hope for is to get his handlers. And it's very unsatisfying when you have to say, well, here's this guy, like a couple of days ago, the supposed second in command of Al-Qaeda in Iraq was arrested. And when you look at him, you think, could that man have really been responsible for killing thousands of people through suicide attacks? Is he really responsible? And so there's a connection, there's a disconnect that we have, okay, that we can't feel that there's any sense of justice there. And so we tend to react with hopelessness. There's nothing that can be done. There's nothing that can combat this particular phenomenon. Now, we'd like to highlight a couple of different occurrences of suicide attacks which were not repeated. Okay, and consider what might, and obviously we can bring out some perhaps in the discussion as well, what might be stopping suicide attacks in certain places. Okay, for example, let's consider, for example, the Morocco suicide attacks that happened in 2003 in Casablanca. They've never been repeated. And for some reason, this tactic was simply so rejected by the society, it was not a success, that it was simply closed off by the society. I feel that there might be a good chance that Jordan is another example of that, where we have this very dramatic suicide attack that happens last November, shocking the society, which had up till then been quite supportive of suicide attacks in Iraq and to some extent also among Palestinians. And yet that particular suicide attack then was so jarring that it might have even brought about any sort of an end to any sort of support that could have been developing inside the country of Jordan. Okay, and there can be other examples, but widespread public protest does appear to actually work to some extent, and I think that the response of the Jordanians and the Moroccans most adequately exemplifies that. Now, where hasn't that worked? It hasn't worked in Egypt, and it hasn't worked in Pakistan. In both cases, you've also had widespread public revulsion at suicide attacks, and yet they still have continued. And so there's a mixed bag right there. You can't say that widespread public revulsion will necessarily bring an end to suicide attacks, but you can say that it does in certain cases. Another thing that we'd like to focus upon is the religious role of fatwas. What is a fatwa? Fatwa is a religious opinion that scholars give to support or to justify a particular action or course of events. On a regular basis today, religious scholars, religious Muslim scholars, are asked to give opinions on a wide range of events. I've seen fatwas on the internet asking whether aliens can be Muslims. You know, what can you say? How could you answer that question? But at any rate, these sort of fatwas, however, are extremely widespread that support suicide attacks. The best collection of them is to be found in Nawaf Taqruri's book, Al-Amaliyat al-Istishadiyya fi al-Mizan al-Faqih, The Suicide Attack and Martyrdom Operations in the Legal Balance, which first appeared actually in 1997 in Damascus and has been revised four times since then, the fourth edition appearing in 2004, and includes a selection of approximately 70 fatwas supported by a wide range of Muslim communities really throughout the world. Now, this achieves something of a broad consensus within the Muslim community, okay, and is something that definitely needs to be dealt with. Now, it's important, however, to focus upon what these fatwas say and what they don't say. Most of the fatwas that are written up in places like that support suicide attacks within the Arab-Israeli conflict setting, especially among Palestinians. But, however, these fatwas are also very secondarily used by al-Qaeda. Okay, and they make the argument that any place where Muslims are under attack, where there's some sort of attack by the United States, then those fatwas are oftentimes applicable. Okay, making the argument that the United States and Israel are one entity, essentially. Now, this is an extremely dangerous argument to make because it globalizes the whole issue of suicide attacks. Excuse me. Most Muslim religious scholars that are mainstream would seek to localize them as best as possible within the Arab-Israeli conflict setting, maybe a little bit in Chechnya to some extent, or maybe in Kashmir, but certainly not in Europe, and certainly not in Muslim-majority countries or against Arabs. Okay, so one of the problems that is happening right now is that widespread use of fatwas. Fatwas appear all over the internet. They give religious legitimacy to attacks, suicide attackers. And it's not that difficult for very radical sheikhs, for example, to take these fatwas and to use them in a global sense. Now, we strongly think that this should be that people should be held accountable for this. And we think that really when we're talking about the religious basis for the use of martyrdom operations, we have to start with the radical sheikhs and even the mainstream sheikhs that actually do support this material and give it credence. Okay, now, and that's a major problem because these books and booklets, personally, I think that the role of books and booklets inside the support for martyrdom operations is gradually going down. I think that more and more of these books are being banned in the Muslim world. But at the same time, their appearance on the internet is going up. And so once this material is out on the internet, then it can be used widely. Now, aside from the political issues that are brought out by martyrdom operations, one of the most important themes that runs through martyrdom operations literature is the word humiliation. And this is something that we both feel needs to be confronted within the Muslim world. There's a strong perception of collective humiliation of Muslims, and this feeds into a conspiracy theory, a very large conspiracy theory that the entire world, or at least usually the United States or parts of Europe and so forth, are actually actively trying to destroy Islam or fight Islam. And obviously this rhetoric gives an absolute reason to carry out martyrdom operations. If Islam is under danger, then there's necessity to defend it in this manner. And so that type of rhetoric actually gives credence to those that would seek to use martyrdom operations. So we would We think that it's necessary to confront that whole issue of humiliation, of persecution, and if possible, even the conspiracy theory. So we can leave that open to discussion and so forth. We also would like to ask the question about who carries out suicide attacks. Now, this is something that Robert Pape has done a great deal of work on. Others have tried to carry out some sort of a Uber profile of who is the likely suicide attacker. This is not something that we dealt with that much in our research, but we'd like to start off with the point that there is no profile. Pape managed to gather a profile because he limited his, he essentially stacked his decks. He focused mostly upon some various different conflicts that were very occupation-oriented and ignored those particular, fortunately he happened to publish his book, just right at that particular point where martyrdom operations made the transition into the larger world. And so he was able to ignore things like the Pakistani suicide attacks, those in Uzbekistan and others, that have effectively changed the situation so radically that it's impossible now to speak of any profile. The profile is that there's no profile. Women, children, and so forth, anybody can use martyrdom operations. However, having said that, we still can speak about some danger groups. And mainly these focus upon kind of that undefinable group that is transitioning their religious status. And that comes from two basic different sets. One of those is non-religious or semi-secular Muslims that gradually transition into becoming more and more religious. This is a group that is very open to the claims of radical Islam, its absolutist claims, and it lacks the intellectual and religious depth to be able to combat the claims that are made oftentimes by those who would push martyrdom operations. Another group that is sensitive to this sort of thing is converts to Islam. Okay, during the recent past, we're beginning to see the appearance of more and more converts to Islam inside the use of suicide attacks. So, where does that leave us? Unfortunately, it leaves us nowhere, and neither one of us support the issue of profiling. We think that it's a dangerous step to go towards, although it's very open to discussion. But we would like to caution against the use of that material for the purposes of profiling. With that, I'd like to finish off and make the transition into to our discussion. Thank you.
Certainly open to your questions and comments. We have, let me just turn this off. We have a couple microphones here. If you would just please identify yourself and keep your question or comment as brief as possible. If you seem to be violating the public speaking rules here, I'll probably interrupt you, just so you know that. Why don't we start right here, we'll go to this gentleman, then we'll go here and here. Go ahead, take the microphone.
We'll go with this.
Because we put this on, by the way, we put this on, oftentimes these are broadcast on our website, the CSS website, just so you know.
Right. I'm Frank Dow from George Washington University. I'm a senior research scientist there. I've actually been involved extensively in the reconstruction of Iraq and other places over a period of time, and have familiarity with the Middle East, 7 years of work with the UN in the Middle East, so I know the Middle East quite well. The one, I think, comment I'd like to make is that both of you seem to have focused on the Middle East rather much in your analysis, and there is a whole Asian dimension to this that needs to be looked at that may be slightly different. Now, the phenomenon of suicide bombing is beginning to grow in Asia. Bali, the Philippines, a number of instances that I can quote and you probably are aware of. And I'm wondering whether that comparison isn't worth looking at at some point, because it may be slightly different in focus and in tendency. And the other issue that I'd like to raise, and neither of you raised this, to what extent is suicide bombing gender sensitive or a gender issue? Increasingly, one sees and one hears of women becoming more involved in this, and perhaps an analysis to that effect would be quite useful at some point, because I feel that we've probably moved into a new phase in all of this, with evidence that shows that more and more women are getting recruited and are involved in these sorts of operations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Actually, in our analysis here, we were fairly Middle Eastern focused, but that isn't reflective of the way we wrote the book. It's purely an issue of time that we didn't focus a little bit more on the Indonesian and South Asian aspects. Yes, I agree that one of my problems actually with Pape's analysis is that he tends to group the Indonesian material together with Al-Qaeda, which I think is not necessarily justified from my knowledge of Jama'a Islamiyah. I interviewed a number of their leaders and so forth when I was in Indonesia, and I do feel that there is a substantial difference between their methodology and their relationship with the larger radical Muslim group. Jama'a Islamiyah has essentially split over the issue of the use of suicide attacks. The most prominent book dealing with that is that of Imam Samudra, the spiritual leader of the Bali operations and so forth, where he talks about his intellectual dependency upon the Middle Eastern material, but he protests, really, just the same way as Al-Qaeda does, that it should be used in a global sense. Now, he was critiqued very strongly for that by none other than Abu Bakr Bashir, who has gradually moved away from such a free use of suicide attacks, and I think back more to the original calling of the Jama'a Islamiyah, which tended to be much more of a society of Muslims that was supposed to be sort of a counter or inner society rather than actually a revolutionary society, and that it was supposed to at another later time make the transition into that, into, you know, perhaps armed struggle, but certainly not as soon as the Bali bombings. And so essentially the Bali bombings took Jama'a Islamiyah by surprise. And it's not surprising that during the recent past, the group has essentially split over that particular issue. So I think that there is some room for discussion about that. Another place that there might be some suicide attacks in the near future might be Thailand. Southern Thailand definitely seems to be open to that sort of thing. I did not have the chance to visit that area, but I did visit the area of Malaysia that's contiguous with it, and there was some support for possible martyrdom operations. But to date, they're very hypothetical. The ICG has analyzed the possibility of martyrdom operations appearing in southern Philippines. It does not appear to me like the Filipino radical Muslim groups are going to go in that direction. But, you know, it's always a possibility. So, yeah, so that's the answer to your first question, at least my answer to it. The issue of the gender roles is definitely, yeah, that's something that's being developed by a number of there's been so many books written on female suicide attackers. It's amazing. Of the maybe 12 major books on suicide attackers, at least 6 of them are on women suicide attackers. And so I think that this particular analysis has actually been done between Bloom and, what is her name, Claudia Brunner, who's analyzed the suicide attacker, the female suicide attackers in the Palestinian sense and so forth, and a number of different other writers. So we're not dealing with that specifically. We don't view it as being central.
But we did devise a model of motivation for the leaders versus the actual attackers, and there's definitely been some research that shows that there are definite differences in what they say, why they're carrying out a suicide attack. So for leaders, a lot of times it's more global things, or like establishing caliphate, or you know, long-term strategic goals. But for bombers, there's much different considerations, because they won't be there to be, you know, part of these long-term strategic goals. So there are a lot of different motivations for the individual attackers, and some of them are personal, and a lot of them are either revenge or personal kind of compromise in a religious sense. Maybe they have been involved in different relationships, especially it's a much stronger sway for female attackers than maybe for male attackers. So a lot of times maybe they're divorced or something, and it's potentially a much stronger motivation. It's much stronger divide between long-term strategic goals for the organization and the individual attackers. So that is something that we did deal with.
I think we're going to have, we have so many questions that maybe what we'll do is take three or four and let the panel speak to those together. So why don't we just grab this next group here. Here comes Sasha with a microphone, and then right here, and then we'll just move it around. We'll try to get you all, get your questions on the floor if we could.
Stuart Goldman from the Congressional Research Service. Two questions, one for each of the presenters. Olivia, first, can you tell us when Al Jazeera shifted its policy in terms of using in a somewhat laudatory way the term Muharram operations, and under what circumstances was that shift made? And David, you spoke about the possibly effective role of widespread public demonstrations in a society in Morocco, for example, and possibly in Jordan, as an effective way of shutting down such operations, while at the same time acknowledging that the same widespread public demonstrations in Pakistan and Egypt had no such effect. What's your basis for concluding that it was the demonstrations in Morocco and Jordan which had the effect rather than some other explanation?
Yes.
Samira Daniels. You mentioned that there were suicide bombings in Pakistan. Over a period of when to when and how many were there? And why do you make such a distinction between the suicide bombings that are Asian? I mean, I still haven't grasped what is that distinction that you're after or trying to convey.
Let me take a couple more here. Let's just this gentleman over here, and then back to you. Sorry, sir. And then back here, and then we'll take a break, and there'll be enough questions.
My name is Radwan Masmoudi with the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. I have two questions. The first one is on the question of democracy and how much impact it has on support for terrorism. Could it be the case that Morocco and Jordan had such a negative reaction to terrorism precisely because they have more freedom than, say, Egypt or Pakistan? And the second question, you mentioned this issue of the feeling that there is a war against Islam. And I just returned from Tunisia and Morocco and Jordan, especially after the last war between Lebanon and Hezbollah and Israel. I can tell you that the people I spoke with, about 80 or 90% of them are convinced that there is a war against Islam. And the popularity of Hezbollah and of suicide bombing is in that range right now, in about 80 or 90%. I was very alarmed. How do we address this issue of the humiliation? How do we address this issue of the feeling that there is a war against Islam? And that's it. Thank you.
I think these questions are so challenging that why don't we take these and then move to the next round.
Okay. Al Jazeera made that shift. I think there was a policy that was sent out sometime in 2005, early 2005, that was sent out. I talked to several different correspondents for Al Jazeera and some other Arab, pan-Arab news organizations, and a lot of them aren't actually happy about it. A lot of them want to be able to use the word martyr when referring to, especially Palestinian. It depends country by country what they consider to be a legitimate suicide bombing operation or something. But I think it was definitely in 2005, early 2005, when Al Jazeera sent out the memo and said, we're not going to be using this term. Whether it's been fully carried out by the correspondents and things like that is another question. But In response to what you asked, I think it was probably in response to a lot of the criticism that was happening just in general. If Al Jazeera wanted to stand up, you know, on a global stage and say that we're as unbiased as Western channels, and their opinion of Western channels bias is also different maybe than our opinion of Western channels. But if they wanted to stand up and legitimize themselves, they needed to, they felt, get rid of language like that. And at least just use, they actually don't use the term suicide bomber that much. A lot of times they're just using the term bomber, or a bombing was carried out or something like that. So it's a lot of passive voice now.
Okay, as far as the demonstrations issue, I mean, first of all, I have to qualify myself. I mean, there's no way that we can know as far as, I mean, there simply hasn't been enough time in a place like Jordan to know whether suicide bombing will not return. It's not even been a year since the major suicide bombing in Amman. And I do not know absolutely whether it was precisely the demonstrations that stopped these sort of things, or even whether they are stopped. But I think that there was a sense in both Jordan and in Morocco that these things are too much. They should not be directed against Muslims. And that you find in that many of the plots that were previously unnoticed and so forth then are being informed upon by the population, who are now sensitized to the possibility that people might actually use suicide attacks against Muslims, whereas previously they'd always been an outside sort of phenomenon. Whether the demonstrations or revulsion actually will stop the suicide attacks, I'm not certain. The reason why I brought that up is because I think that it's important to realize the limitations of what such popular revulsion can do. To some extent, it might be able to stop in certain cases, you know, where there is a certain element of democracy, and one cannot ignore things like the disassociation of Zarqawi's family from him after he carried out the Amman attacks and so forth. So I think that there was a sense of response to public opinion that appeared inside both of those societies. Now, since I'm on the subject, I'll try and deal with your question, not forgetting the other questions, but the issue of whether these things are connected to democracy, or whether democracy would prevent, or the appearance of democracy would actually prevent the use of suicide attacks, I am not certain that that would be the case. It is true that both Pakistan and Egypt are much less of democratic states than Jordan or Morocco, even though the two others are monarchies and so forth. And it's true that other more open Arab societies like Tunisia have never really suffered suicide attacks, except for the Al-Qaeda one in Jerba, which was pretty much an anomaly. But I'm not sure that that's the antidote, even though I strongly support the appearance of democracy in the Arab world. I'm just not sure that that's precisely the antidote for suicide attacks in that particular sense. Do you want to?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we also kind of, in the course of our research, we found that to some degree there is, related to the idea of perceived humiliation and also from the government, if people feel that they don't have options for changing things, a lot of times those are the societies that will experience recurrent. I mean, that might be the influence of democracy would be, you know, if you don't feel like you have any other voice or something like that, then... And if you don't feel like you have any option for change. So it might be places where there have been a lot of harsh repression of people over a long period of time. And so I think it would depend also on, in terms of democracy appearing, it might also depend on how democracy appears, if it looks like it's coming in from the West and being imported versus if it's in the form of kind of a peaceful, like, grassroots up idea. I think it would be a very different response to those things.
Now, about your comments about Hezbollah, et cetera, I agree that probably the support for Hezbollah right at this particular point is extremely high, and the admiration for it is extremely high. But it's also important to realize that they didn't use any suicide attacks at this particular campaign. A month went by of fighting, and yet there were absolutely no suicide attacks. And so this was not a victory, whatever you want to call it, for suicide attacks. And I don't know whether I really feel like the general analysis within the Muslim world, or the Arab Muslim world, let's say, is that suicide attacks really work. Perhaps 5 years ago, that might have been the analysis, maybe even up until 2004 and so forth. But I think that their prevalence within other different spheres, and the fact that they so clearly have not worked within the Palestinian sphere, and that they've been abandoned by things like Hezbollah and so forth, I think might even suggest the opposite. So there might be a sort of a passive openness towards suicide attacks, but I don't know that that necessarily translates out to admiration for the tactic as a useful one. On the other hand, as a knee-jerk response, oftentimes people will say, yeah, I support suicide attacks, but those who are actually planning these sort of things out, I think, are gradually moving away from them. So, okay, and then the question about why Asian things are slightly different. Well, I don't necessarily think that they're completely divorced from them, but first of all, the Pakistani case is clearly sectarian, and it's deriving its support from the sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Shiites, and the dynamic there is different from the one that you find among globalist radical Muslims. Okay, there's no videos. Nobody even knows, in a lot of cases, who carried these things out. There's no proclamation of these guys as martyrs. In general, it's not even certain who precisely are the groups. Usually the groups don't proclaim their who exactly carried out given operations and so forth. So I think that the Pakistani ones are slightly different. Now, when you move to Kashmir, then there's more of a pride sort of thing. Usually the names are known, but there's generally not videos. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, there's been about 15 or so that have been carried out since 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's not counting the Kashmir conflict, where there's been maybe about, yeah, more like that. So, but those are more obviously of a military or at least semi-military nature. So, and then when you move to a place like Bangladesh, again, clearly this is a conflict that is against the government, protesting about different things that really have nothing to do with westernization at all. Most of the suicide attacks that took place there in 2004 were against the court system. Okay?
Borders on that's just my impression.
Okay.
How do you address
that? Oh, I am so sorry. I forgot about that. Yeah. Forget about the issue of humiliation. It's so huge. So we'll just solve that problem right here and now. How do we address humiliation? This is something that I agree. It's just I don't know where we can go with it, and I'm not sure that I have any particular answer for the question. But part of what I would start to talk about is to encourage Arabs not to dwell upon it. When you read the literature and stuff, and you see how much they mention it and so forth, and how much people talk about it. It's something that I think is very one-sided. Personally, I mean, as a Westerner, as I travel around in the Muslim world, I don't feel that sense. I don't feel like it should be that way. I mean, I'm very conscious of actually Muslim accomplishments. and so it's very difficult for me to understand why on earth there's such a perception of humiliation. But I definitely think that focus upon certain individual political things that are not going to go away, or certain economical and cultural realities, like the United States being a major power, or dominance in the world having passed from the Muslim Middle East to Europe, let's say, or to other different non-Muslim countries, it's not going to go away. But the fact is that Muslims, if they wanted to, could focus upon self-worth. And so I think at least the first step would be to stop feeling like everything in the world is a humiliation. Now, how to make that happen, I can't even speculate. I don't know that I can even address the root of the conflict. The root of that perception, because it's such a deep psychological thing that it's so self-evident to Muslims. You know, when you talk to them, I've asked, you know, why do you feel humiliated? What's the source of that? You know, they sometimes look at me like, you know, like why is the sky blue? You know, it's something that's even deeper and huger than our research, I suppose you might say. But we would like to point it out because, I mean, like all positivists, I think that we feel that the issues can be confronted eventually and dealt with, maybe even if we can't do it ourselves.
Yeah, maybe I can just jump in on that for a second. I think some of our research, in particular our recent work in Pakistan, showed that it was rather widespread and rather historic and rather and had quite a foundation, that it wasn't just among any class of society. It was really through all classes of society, and they saw the way we deal with their leaders. For example, maybe you could turn off your mics just because we don't get so much feedback. The way we deal with their leaders, a fairly typical phrase on our policymaking side of things would be, well, you know, we give this guy $2 billion. I mean, why isn't he dancing to our tune? That suggests a certain kind of master relationship, which isn't really received particularly well. I can go back to some research that I did back in Mindanao when we were designing a program there. And as we talked to the mayor of, I think it was General Santos City at the time, she happened to be a Roman Catholic scholar, but she had done a survey of the attitudes of Catholics towards Muslims and of Muslims towards Catholics. And it just so happened that the Catholics' feelings about Muslims happened to be very negative. They thought they were dirtier, not as smart, and a variety of other things. And there was a direct contrast in her numbers. There was a dramatic contrast in her numbers. So this comes down to one of these issues, such as racism and sexism, that I think a lot of us try to get an intellectual understanding of, but I'm not convinced that we actually have a very good appreciation of. And so we talk about it, and we say, and then the minute that something goes wrong, we fall back on one of those explanations. And I think our policy reflects that in many, many, many ways in our language. The mentions, the multiple mentions that Leora highlighted from the national strategy really are not necessarily the result of enlightenment, but more partially a result of kind of a provocation, of a way to justify our actions, and probably an excessive focus on ourselves rather than on the people that we're dealing with, the years of colonialism and the other experiences that they obviously, in almost every case that we're talking about, have had. So it's really, I do think that recognizing it as much more than just a sort of get over it kind of problem is going to be essential. And I'm not sure that we advance that, the sense that we actually appreciate it, with are putting it into sort of an ism. And I think you hinted at that in your remarks. I mean, I thought your policy choices in terms of watching the rhetoric was certainly one piece of that. Let's go to, I know there are lots of good questions and comments here. I think we had this gentleman first, and then I think we have one back here, and then we'll come back to you with the third one, and then we'll probably take a break because you probably will have stumped us by that point.
My name is Charles Dahan. I'm the World Vice President of the Moroccan Jewry. You mentioned Morocco in your discussion, and I hope that that there will be no more bombing in Morocco, suicide bombing.
Inshallah.
Unfortunately, last month, over 70 people were arrested they were on the brink of a new wave of suicide bombing. So I don't believe that Morocco is over with it. They may be on top of it right now. One thing that you didn't mention, it's about the level of education of the suicide bombers and the people in general that are involved in suicide bombing. And there was a couple of points I wanted to raise. There is no uniform condemnation by Muslim leaders around the world. And you mentioned Morocco reacted and the population rejected its suicide bombing. I think a lot of other countries had the same reaction, maybe not as vocal as we had it in Morocco, but the fact is, in general, most people are against suicide bombing. The third point I was trying to raise also on the motivation of suicide bombers and what can we do and why do they do it besides being radicalized. You didn't mention that some of them or some of their family were paid money. And in the Palestinian case in particular, a lot of suicide bombers' family received money. And I think it was a great motivation.
Please take the mic just because otherwise when we tape this, we won't, on the broadcast.
Yes, Paul Murphy is my name. I run the website Russia Eurasia Terror Watch. I'm also the author of Wolves of Islam, Russia in the Faces of Chechen Terror. You included Chechnya as a piece of your overall research in your work. I was wondering if you could tell us how you did research on Chechnya or the North Caucasus. And secondly, if you could share with us some of your conclusions on anything regarding suicide terrorists, that is either bombers or hostage takers in the North Caucasus of Chechnya. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. I think we can set this gentleman here, if we can get him, and then we'll get you so you don't have to flail all day.
I just wanted to throw out a couple of thoughts on presentations and respond as you feel appropriate. First of all, you hinted at this, but you didn't get to the bottom of it. The same word shuhada is used for the martyrs who do the operations as for the victims of the operations. And it's probably a lot harder religiously to justify the word shuhada for the victims, the civilian victims, as it is for the... So I was just wondering if any effort you suggested that you may have surveyed some of these fatwas and other religious justifications is there? I think the easiest argument to make back against the whole idea of a martyrdom operation, the shuhada victim, would be to say these are not the martyrs, that the civilian victims are not martyrs. I just wondered if you could talk about that specifically a little bit. Second thing is, and this was touched on briefly in Mr. Barton's comments. There's a long history of terrorizing populations here. Suicide bombing, as you suggested, is just the most recent manifestation. So I was just wondering, in terms of the literature that's now being created, if people are going back. I mean, you can look at huge forest fires in the late 19th century, wide-ranging kidnappings in the early 20th century, and this is all as part of the anti-colonial struggles, bombings at mid-century, massacres and target assassinations, further through that period. So there's a long history here of terrorizing populations, and the solutions to those situations are probably going to be, or may not be, quite similar to the solutions country by country in these cases. So I was just wondering if the literature sort of getting into that long history here. And third sort of comment, and I wondered if you thought about this as well. During the Algerian conflict in the 50s, there was... And you can get some of this if you watch Battle of Algiers. But there's this whole literature. Franz Fanon was the most famous writer in this area of talking about the bombing, the attack as cathartic for oppressed people. And I wondered if A, Fanon's been resurrected. B, if there's a new sort of psychological literature on those lines. And finally, as we think about humiliation, whether we're thinking along those terms. And one little last thing I'll throw out. Muhammad Hafiz in Why Muslims Rebel talks about, you know, social movement theory and justice frames and all that. And I think that's very useful thing to bring up in answer to the humiliation question that I brought up. But also, I would say your own research points at an even better thing, which is these personal reasons you were referring to, the bombers down at the bottom level, is loosely related to the injustice frames. And I think this is the weakness in the social movement theory approach, right? Is loosely related to that, but there's this whole, you know, wealth of other personal rhythms and personal narratives of humiliation which are outside of what's framed for these people. I know the Algeria case best, but the whole concept of hogra, you know, which is ingrained in sort of youth rebellion against the regime, his whole book's written on it, is there. And I think, you know, therein lies the solution. It's understanding that the, as you suggested, the rich complexity of this historical antecedents, you know, cultural, economic. It's very, very, but I would say, and it relates to the theme of revenge as well, but I would say the key thing, and this is my final point, and I look at this as a social historian, the key thing is acts of, you know, violent humiliation of the population. You know, in Algeria it was October 1998, and how that was never dealt with properly by the government. And as you look around each of these countries, you can find moments, watershed moments of and violence, you know, perpetrated on the population in the view of the victims of it that was never properly addressed. And then a lot of this is fallout.
Okay, thank you very much. Wow, we have so many questions here. I don't know where to even begin. Okay, first of all, dealing with the level of education of the suicide attackers, pretty much Pape has done, I think, the basic research on that subject. And his conclusions, more or less, are that the level of education is fairly higher. It's not; these are not the trash of society. In general, they are middle range, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. That's contributing to our feeling that there's really no particular profile here. But definitely one should avoid the idea that this is a phenomenon that's completely associated with uneducated people. There are very highly educated people that you can find that carry out suicide attacks. And, of course, many of the leaders, think about the leaders of the September 11th attacks and so forth, were fairly well educated. And certainly had definite good possibilities in society. And quite a number of the Palestinians and Iraqi bombers fall into that category as well. Now, Pape's analysis really ends off in 2003. I think that if you were to take the range of suicide attackers since that time, I think that you would find that his conclusions continue. I haven't seen anything that would indicate otherwise. So,
David, can I ask you one question on that just as a follow-up? Has the data for these people, the suicide bombers, does it differ dramatically from the data on suicide sort of population in general? Hmm. Has anybody done that analysis?
You know, I don't think that anybody has. If there isn't, that's actually an intriguing point, which I never considered. Suicide bombers. I have not examined that angle. So
that's your next question.
Well, I know that I feel like that there is some. I'll just throw this out just for just because it's kind of a thought that's on my mind. But I feel that up until definitely the middle 1990s, there really was a very strong taboo against suicide in the Muslim world that gradually has actually been weakened to some extent by this particular phenomenon, perhaps of suicide attacks. You definitely find much more talk, for example, in the Pakistani press and others, Jordanian press, you can find a great deal more discussion about suicides, actually, than you ever did in times prior to that. And so I don't know whether there's actually a connection because, you know, I haven't researched that angle, but it's something that I've thought about a little bit, that perhaps there might be infrequent discussions of suicide attacks and glorification of them, there might actually be something of a spillover effect into something of a noble suicide, the way that one finds in Western tradition, where one, in order to justify honor, for example, maybe commits suicide. But that's entirely a speculation that I haven't taken it further. Yes, correct that there's not uniform condemnation of suicide attacks. I think that that's an accurate perception. In general, the condemnation is going to be the strongest where suicide attacks kill Muslims or Muslims only. And then second strongest where they kill, especially in like Europe or in the United States, where they kill targets that are not obviously understood to be enemies of Muslims. Although, of course, the anger at the United States is fairly widespread in terms of dislike of Bush and different other policies, that doesn't necessarily translate over into actual support for September 11th. What it translates over more into is the feeling that Muslims didn't do September 11th, rather than some sort of a feeling like that was a justified operation. So there's still going to be a fairly strong condemnation of things like the London bombings, September 11th, and so forth, and different other suicide attacks that that target only Western. The place where you're going to find the strongest support for suicide attacks is going to be Palestinians, where there's fairly widespread consensus that that's a justified tactic. And then others, there's on an individual level, for example, in Pakistan, there sometimes can be strong support for suicide attackers, but also sometimes there can be a backlash against that. So there's a mixed bag that you find. But definitely there's not uniform condemnation. Now, the issue of the paid money, I think that it's important to point out the limitations of what that's affecting. I think that that's not actually generating more suicide attackers. I think it's more of a sweetener after the fact rather than actually prompting people to go out, okay, well, I just cannot make a living, so I'm going to commit suicide and my family will get $25,000 from Saddam. Of course, you know, since the fall of Saddam, that is pretty much dried up. And so there's really no obvious connection now between suicide attackers and the payment of money that I know of. And certainly, you know, in many cases, the suicide attackers, especially those in Iraq, aren't even known. And they certainly don't get paid by anybody. So it's very difficult to identify that, I think. I agree. There's a large component of foreign fighters, but those foreign fighters, they usually are unidentified. You know, their families at best get some sort of a notice. Yeah, your son died in Iraq, and maybe they might see a video of him, like all too often happens on the internet. But
mostly Saudis only.
But mostly Saudis, and they're certainly not going to get paid by the Saudi government.
I don't suggest that the Saudis or any government today is paying suicide bombers.
Mm-hmm.
But the motivation of money at one point for recruiting suicide bombers was there.
I agree, until the fall of Saddam. But since then, you know, you can't deny that was 3 years ago and so forth, and suicide attacking has continued quite noticeably. Ah, Chechnya. Okay. Well, you have focused on a little weakness in our research. and so the comments that we're going to make here are largely circular because we, in fact, used your book. So we also used others. Now, we did travel in areas that were contiguous.
Could you mention his title so that he can get his one more plug?
So, and we obviously have used the available resources on the internet and Russian resources when they're available, which is far from being.
It's difficult to get a lot of information in Russian. Definitely, the Russian information is there's more of it, but than in English a lot of times. But there's still not a lot of it just because of the control of information on the internet. There's a lot of videos that the Chechens have put out, actually, that are continually surfacing, you know, and still being put out on the internet and kind of re-released and remixed and different compilations. But there's not a lot of biographical information about a lot of the suicide bombers. Especially the female ones, there's more information, I think, to some degree in the Russian media. Same thing about what the American press wants to do. which is kind of exotify or make it more exotic, the female suicide bombers, but there's still just not a lot of information.
The places that outside of the Russian and Chechen sources that you can actually find information are actually Saudi and British sources. So there's a strong connection between Saudi radicals and Chechens that you can find reflected in the Arabic literature, and especially about suicide. For example, the most prominent justification of martyrdom operations is the Islamic legitimacy of martyrdom operations penned by the late Yusuf al-Ayyiri, who was the head of the Saudi Arabian branch of al-Qaeda until June 2003. And that was basically written around the question of whether Hawa Barayev was a martyr or not. And it's interesting that he chose actually a female suicide attacker for his first choice, even though she wasn't necessarily the most prominent of all the suicide attackers, even in the early stages of suicide attacking in Chechnya. And there's also martyrologies that you can get from radical British bookstores and websites that sometimes will give you a little bit of information, but I have to admit that the material in Chechnya that we had to work with was pretty weak. So
there's more material, especially in terms of just strictly speaking suicide bombing, because there's a lot of material, a lot of things penned by different leaders in various languages about why they carry out militant organizations and, you know, why they carry out different attacks, but not necessarily about suicide bombers. There's not as many wills and the need to justify it and things like that. So,
yeah. Okay, now dealing with the issue of shuhada as civilians, I have to admit we did not come across anything like that. Is that from the Algerian? Civilians as shuhada?
Yeah.
Okay. I have to admit I don't watch Al Jazeera that much, but I do read the radical Muslim literature quite a lot, and they usually, or I've never seen any of them refer to their inadvertent civilian casualties as shuhada. Usually, what they, because in general, radical Muslims try and avoid using the word shaheed in as much as possible, because you can only know who is a martyr. Only God can know who is a martyr. Yeah,
right.
And so I have to admit that I'm influenced mostly by the radical Muslim literature.
Right.
Olivia will.
I've seen it, and I've heard it from different people who die kind of inadvertently in a lot of those suicide bombings. Not the actual targets, like potentially recruits or people like that. They're definitely maybe not legitimized in that way, but the people who die inadvertently in that, I've definitely seen that. But it's more kind of like they died also in this great liberation of, you know, yeah, yeah.
Okay, you know, I'm finding it difficult to read what you wrote for the what you said for the next one right after that. You said something about terrorization. Let's see here. Oh, the historical antecedents. Yeah, inside the yeah. Now there isn't very much of putting the suicide, the phenomenon of suicide attacks within its historical context. And what is there, I think, is problematic. Basically, when we talk about that, we talk about Christoph Reuter, who wrote A Short History of Suicide Attacking, which I'm sorry, I consider to be rather, yeah, difficult to work with. Robert Pape, of course, is much more scientific, and he adduces different radical groups, which he considers to be antecedents. I don't necessarily agree with all of those. For example, he brings out the Ismaili assassins of the 11th and 12th centuries. I don't agree with that, to be absolutely frank. Actually, I intend to write an article about that. Because basically the assassins really did not commit suicide. We seek to define suicide attacking as really those attacks where the attacker, in order to carry out the attack, must die. Okay, and really before the development of high explosives, it's really hard to picture that in classical Islamic literature. You find a couple of mentions of it in 14th century works where there's beginning to be developed stuff like modern firearms and so forth. But it's really not until the present time that you actually find detailed discussions of the sort of thing that we could call suicide attacks. Personally, I think that the historical antecedents don't go back much more than the Japanese kamikazes. But as I say, Pape has a different opinion. I've polemicized with him and so forth. And yeah, that's the way it goes. Franz Fanon is great to read. But radical Muslims today don't appear to use him very much. So his analysis of violence as catharsis, I think, does have something to do with the humiliation narrative. Okay, carrying out a suicide attack, then you're rising above the situation, maybe emboldening your country, your people, your civilization, etc. Now, that particular discourse, though, is much more of the revolutionary Marxist, third worldist type, and it doesn't resonate very well with radical Muslims, to the best of my knowledge. They might use some of the same vocab, but not very much. But it's a provocative thought. I mean, I would love... It's just the sort of thing that Abu Musab is... I haven't read all the way through his Da'wa al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya al-Alamiyya, which, you know, if anybody reads through that, they can read through anything. But, I mean, it's very popular and stuff, and it's just the sort of thing that could have the philosophy of Franz Fanon behind it. So, yeah. Do you want to go?
I think we have a question here. How many other questions do we have? We'll do these... four questions this round, and then I've got a couple questions, and we'll try to finish in about 12 minutes.
I am Yolan Miller-Granvaux from the United States Agency for International Development, and my question has to do with education. Do you see correlations with higher education institutions or even lower education institutions and suicide bombers? And in your profile, could you also comment on the age of... do you have any information or data on the age of the bombers? Thank you.
Sasha, if you could get that person right down in line.
My name is Sadia. I work here at the CSIS as a web assistant. I was wondering for Mr. Cook, despite the fact that there's a lot of rationalizations that justify suicide bombings with religion, is it possible to use religion more as a response to suicide bombing to say that it's not allowed? I would think that I don't really hear a lot of that in the media or in the government, but I would think it would be effective, especially when you have a naive population that's being brainwashed by, you know, like the leaders of these operations, for example, new converts or secular Muslims who had no prior experience with religion, or largely illiterate populations like in Pakistan, or, you know, where there's a lot of poverty and not a lot of hearsay and rumors rather than critical analysis. Thank you.
I think we have some folks right here, yes.
Stand so I don't block everybody's view. Charlotte Sullivan, I'm a doctoral student at George Washington University, and my thesis covers ways to impede the motivation process with regard to suicide terrorists. My question is this. One such example, and then I'll get to my question, Abdullah Karan, who was a preteen young boy, was set up to cross an Israeli border, and I'm sure you two are familiar, but I'll go ahead and give the description. Was set up to cross an Israeli border, and when the IDF pulled him over to search his backpack, found explosive materials in his backpack, a cell phone rang, the bomb had failed. When they interrogated him later, it found out that the whole thing was a setup. He had no idea it was in his bag. So there has been no outcry or no discussion whatsoever about those who are not actually intentional bombers but are actually set up and detonated remotely with no intention of having exploded themselves. Why has this not occurred?
Take a couple other easy ones.
My name is Sophie Rutenbar, and I'm with the Center for Public Integrity, and I just have a couple quick questions. One is, there's been a little bit of talk about the media situation in Baghdad, and in particular the range of television stations, many of which are allied with particular factions and ideologies. And I was wondering if you had looked at all at maybe the suicide bombing ethos being promoted through those stations. And then the other question that I had for you was, you said that you went to 15 African countries, and I was wondering if any of those were sub-Saharan African countries, and if you could talk a little bit about what you found there. Thanks.
Shannon, do you have a question?
Yes. Shannon Hayden with CSIS. This is a question for Ms. Allison. Just the sites like YouTube, what kind of official response have there been to them? I know there's some policing mechanisms within YouTube to make sure no illegal activities are seen, but presumably propaganda wouldn't be something they police for. And I wanted to know if there was any official U.S. government pressure put on them, anything like that.
Okay. Well, another set of heavy questions here. Okay, talking about the issue of education once again. This is material that we mostly relied upon PAPE and others who did statistical analyses of the suicide attackers, and I mean there's the profile that you're getting generally is, as I said, above the mean average as far as educational level. It's certainly not the lowest of the heap. There are some that are really extremely low, but there's also some that are extremely high. And so it doesn't really average out to anything particularly meaningful. As far as the age goes, the classical profile is really of the young, unmarried male, usually earlier than 20, but sometimes up to maybe about 25, middle 20s and so forth. But that's been skewed so much by the appearance of all sorts of different other factors that it's effectively become meaningless. And basically, when you look at PAPE, you can just see that the age level has just moved to the median age inside of the particular society that you're talking about. So you don't get really much of a sense from that. But on the other hand, it's still basically younger males that we're talking about. Not that you can be that's of any use in profiling terms, but it does help us out a little bit to some extent. As far as the issue of religion as response, that was one thing that I definitely wanted to bring out inside the book, and so I'll just summarize my findings here. There's three basic responses that you find. One of them is has to do with suicide attacks as actual suicide. Now, this is very closely associated with the Saudi Arabian leader Ibn Uthaymin, whose religious leadership is quite well known throughout the Sunni world. And he really is probably the best example of somebody who just categorically opposed suicide attacks on that ground. And he never came out in support of suicide attacks among Palestinians. He simply said, it's suicide all the way around, and that suicide is going to be in hell no matter what. It doesn't matter whether they were thinking that they were doing a good job, whatever. The second grounds upon which you find religious attacks has to do with the critique of suicide attacks as being associated with jihad, as being an illegitimate form of jihad, and that's most closely associated with Nasser al-Din al-Albani, the late Salafi leader in Damascus, who frequently attacked suicide attacks on those particular grounds, that they kill illegitimate targets. I alluded to this a little bit inside my lecture. A third grounds that you find actually among radical Muslims, it's kind of a little bit more intriguing. It's based upon the Quranic verse 60 from Surah 61:6. Which talks about jihad as being a collective, anonymous activity, that God loves those who fight in his way as if they were a single building, a single organization. And so radical Muslims from several different organizations have actually critiqued suicide attacks on the basis of the fact that suicide attackers inevitably gain fame after their death. And so it isn't money that that drives them on, but actually the fame that they'll gain. And since there's no way that they can stop that, okay, that actually suicide attacks are illegitimate because they are tainted in some way or another by that desire to gain fame, which makes the essential jihad illegitimate. This is kind of an intriguing religious argument, which has swayed, as I say, several different groups and so forth. You can find it in the Risala al-Umda al-Jihad, which is associated with Saudi radical groups and so forth, and several different other prominent pieces of literature. Okay. Oh, non-intentional bombers. Okay, so this is a question. This is something that's come up quite a lot. To what extent are we talking about brainwashing? To what extent are we talking about somebody who's being used and perhaps as some sort of as a human bomb without their knowledge, or maybe they think they're delivering something, but they're actually the bomb. Perhaps in some cases in Iraq, they've found people that have been chained to steering wheels and so forth. To what extent are those people actually free? No, there's no condemnation of that sort of thing that you find in any of the radical Islamic literature. In general, the attitude is that God will give them their reward. It's the same sort of thing that you find with the civilian sort of thing. If you kill Muslims, then God essentially, you know, God will sort them out. So you do not find any discussion of that that I've seen. Have you seen any?
No.
Okay. Now you can deal with the media situation in Baghdad.
Well, actually, I think it would be a good idea for a whole other exploration. I would also like to look at Afghanistan media and the way that they're talking about the different, you know, suicide attacks. It's much more negative. The suicide attacks happening there are happening in one part of the country. Most of the media is owned somewhere else, so there's kind of maybe opposition to it. But I would like to do a better study of, you know, countries' media in the Middle East, but we just didn't, and all over, actually. But we didn't have enough space in the book to really get into things that are not necessarily a threat against, you know, the United States or U.S. targets. So there won't be a lot of maybe Iraqi suicide bombings coming to the U.S. More, we focused on media that was reaching out to kind of converts or people in Europe and America that could, you know, perpetrate a terrorist act here. So basically, I didn't really look at that, but I would like to. And then Africa.
Yeah, Africa. Okay. Yeah, we visited a number of different countries in sub-Saharan Africa. The most prominent that I focused on was Nigeria. And I interviewed quite a number of different religious leadership in Nigeria because I wanted to use it as a test case of a place where radical Islam is spreading, and there are all the preconditions for possible use of suicide attacks. And so I wanted to have a record about whether the ulama there would actually support suicide attacks if they appeared. Now, in general, the paradigm that I've found is that the further away from the Arab world you get, the more the Muslim religious leadership is skeptical about the use of suicide attacks. And that was really quite apparent inside Nigeria, where the prominent leadership really was saying, yes, okay, they're legitimate in Palestine, but other places, yeah, I don't know. And a couple of them, such as Muhammad Isa Bello, was really the leading intellectual, Muslim intellectual in Lagos, interviewed for a number of hours and so forth. He had to say, you know, yeah, I've read this literature. It just does not convince me. And that was the general attitude. You know, it was passive support for Palestinians, but when it gets outside of Palestine, then there's a lot of skepticism. And that's also what we found in Afghanistan. Okay, there's a lot of passive support for Palestinians, but when you start talking about suicide attacks that start to appear in Afghanistan, especially given the fact that that Ahmad Shah Massoud is killed by a suicide attacker, is quite problematic. So we also visited Kenya. Sorry, I was reminded. I'm so interested in Nigeria that I forget that we also visited East Africa. And we didn't manage to really interview any substantial people of importance inside Mombasa. I feel personally like the suicide attacks that happened in Nairobi and Mombasa were really sent from outside and had no popular support in the area. So there was no real sense that suicide attacks had popular support in East Africa. The other place that we interviewed, there's a random comment in Takruri's Amaliyat al-Istishadiyya that suicide attacks took place in southern Sudan. And I was pretty interested to try and figure this one out. But after interviewing the Mujahideen leaders in southern Sudan, they claimed that they never used suicide attacks. And so I don't know what actually to make of that particular comment. Takruri doesn't footnote it, and so I've never been able to follow it up. So, yeah, so we interviewed the in southern Sudan as well.
Okay, and last to your YouTube question. Actually, it was interesting because when you sign up to use, I think, YouTube, that you do agree to some terms and conditions, but it doesn't talk that much about, like, violence or anything like that in terms of objectionable material. But rather than, I think, an official YouTube response or an official, I don't think maybe the government is that aware that YouTube or something is being used in that way. But there are a lot of users who will flag a video as inappropriate. A lot of times I'll go back, it's been taken down because it was inappropriate. Or you have to click, say you're 18 and you can watch this graphic video or something like that. So there's been kind of a user response, but I don't think there's been a concerted like YouTube response or a government response or anything like that.
Well, thank you very much, Olivia, David. I think terrific program. Liora, thank you for being the executive producer. And thank you all for being such lively and engaged participants. Excellent program. Thank you.
Thank you very much.